Welcome to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. I'm Jane Donahue. Today we take you to a talk at the Midcoast Forum on Foreign Relations with diplomat Jake Wallace. The title of today's talk is Conflict in the Middle East: Implications for U.S. Interests. This program was pre-recorded for broadcast at this time, and it will be archived on our website, mainepublic.org. Click on radio to hear the program again at your convenience and to access many other past Speaking in Maine programs. The program will also be available as a podcast.
Good afternoon. Welcome to members and guests who are here today and to those listening to us on the stations of Maine Public Radio. This is our 465th meeting of the Midcoast Forum on Foreign Relations, and it comes to you from the Elks Event Center in Rockland, Maine. I'm George Look. The Midcoast Forum was founded over 40 years ago to hear an invited speaker each month on an issue related to U.S. foreign policy. You can listen to audios of past forum talks and get information about upcoming forum speakers on our website, midcoastforum.org. Recent forum talks are also on the websites of Maine Public Radio, after they air it, and the Maine Monitor. If you're interested in staying informed about key foreign affairs issues, and if you're only a guest here today, for example, please consider becoming a forum member. Our membership form is on the forum's website. Our speaker for today's meeting is Ambassador Jake Wallace, who will be speaking on conflict in the Middle East, implications for U.S. interests. And I can't think of a more timely topic. Jake Wallace is a non-resident senior fellow in the Mideast program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, where he focuses on Israeli-Palestinian issues, Tunisia, and counterterrorism. He was a Foreign Service officer with the Department of State for more than 35 years, serving as a U.S. ambassador to Tunisia from 2012 to 2015 as Consul General and Chief of Mission in Jerusalem from 2005 to 2009. Ambassador Wallace also served as a director of the Office of Israel and Palestinian Affairs and as Deputy Principal Officer at the U.S. Consulate General in Jerusalem. Ambassador Wallace's other assignments include Deputy Chief of Mission in Athens, First Secretary for Economic Affairs in Tel Aviv, Vice Consul in Amsterdam, and Special Assistant to the Undersecretary for Economic Affairs in Washington, D.C. He served as a senior advisor in the State Department's Bureau of Counterterrorism from 2015 to 2017 when he retired. During his long career at the State Department, Ambassador Wallace was actively involved in Middle East peace negotiations, beginning with the Madrid Middle East Peace Conference in 1991 and continuing through the Obama administration. He was a recipient of the State Department's Distinguished Honor Award in 2016 for his contributions to U.S. national security policy. He also was the recipient of Presidential Meritorious Rank Awards in 2007 and 2012, and the Department of State's Superior Honor Award in 2001 and 1994 for his work in promoting peace in the Middle East. As I said, I think the topic is extremely timely, and I'd like to welcome Jake to the Midcoast Forum.
Thank you, George. Well, good afternoon, and thank you all for coming today. I hope this contraption I'm wearing is working and you can hear what I'm saying. It's a pleasure to be back in Maine for the second time in, I think, 3 months. And I want to thank the Midcoast Forum on Foreign Relations for inviting me to speak today, and also for the warm hospitality that everyone in Maine has shown to me. I want to thank George, in particular, for helping to organize this, and my old friend Mika, who helped, as well as Courtney, who took care of all the logistical arrangements. So it's great to be back in Maine. I'm going to be talking about the war in Gaza between Israel and Hamas that has been going on now and dominating global headlines for nearly 6 months. The human toll in Gaza has been staggering. More than 30,000 Palestinians, I think the number now is up to 31,000 Palestinians, have been killed. the majority of them over 70% women and children. Nearly all of Gaza's 2.2 million inhabitants have been displaced and face a daily struggle for the essentials of life: food, water, shelter, and health care. Most of Gaza's economy and infrastructure has been destroyed. And on the Israeli side, roughly 1,200 people were killed by Hamas on October the 7th, the deadliest day in the history of the State of Israel. Hamas fighters deliberately attacked civilian targets and captured hundreds of civilian hostages, many of whom are still held in difficult conditions in Gaza. A UN report has also found evidence supporting claims of sexual violence committed by Hamas attackers on October the 7th. Last night was the first night or the beginning of the Islamic holy month of Ramadan, and there was hope that there would be a ceasefire in place, you know, in time for the holiday. Unfortunately, that did not come about. I'm still hopeful that there will be a ceasefire, and I don't think that the beginning of Ramadan is a deadline in the sense that efforts will not continue. So hopefully, before the end of this month, there will be a ceasefire, but at the moment, the fighting continues. Beyond the fighting in Gaza, the war has also triggered clashes across the region, from the border between Israel and Lebanon to the Red Sea, and also inside Iraq and in Syria. American forces have been involved in exchanges of fire in the Red Sea and in Syria and Iraq, raising the prospect that the U.S. could be dragged into a wider conflict across the Middle East. This situation raises many serious questions about the future of the Middle East and the role of the United States there. In my remarks today, I'm going to discuss how we got there, where it seems we're headed, and what are the broader implications for U.S. interests. Before I get into that, however, I want to say a few words about the heated debate about this war that has consumed this country and the globe over the past 6 months. The Israeli-Palestinian dispute has always evoked strong feelings on both sides, and this has been amplified in recent times by the political polarization that now exists in the United States and many other places around the world. Regrettably, strong feelings about the war have also triggered heightened levels of anti-Semitism and Islamophobia. As a former U.S. diplomat who worked over the years on both sides of this conflict, I try as best as I can to view the situation dispassionately and to evaluate the situation objectively. That has not always been easy, but I think it is important, and I will try to do so as well today. So let me begin with how we got here in this current situation. As I think all of you know, the conflict between Israelis and Palestinians has gone on for a long time now, roughly a century. But the events of the latest chapter began on October 7th of last year, when Hamas staged an audacious attack against military and civilian targets inside Israel, just across the border from Gaza. I think all of you are familiar with the events of that day, so I won't spend a lot of time detailing what happened then. But I will say that Hamas's actions on that day constitute clear violations of international law. I'm not an international lawyer. I'm not an expert in international law. But one thing that is a crucial element of international law is intent. And I think it's clear that Hamas intentionally attacked civilian targets. Hamas intentionally took civilian hostages back to Gaza. And Hamas, or at least the evidence we've seen so far, Hamas intentionally perpetrated sexual violence against some of the victims in Israel. All of those things and that intent, I think, point clearly to the fact that Hamas's actions were violations of international law. The attack left a deep psychological wound on the Israeli psyche, and there was and still is widespread public support in Israel for a strong response against Hamas for the attack that it perpetrated on October the 7th. The Israeli imperative to mount a powerful operation against Hamas is, I think, based on two factors. First, there's a calculated effort by Israel to restore the deterrence against Israel's various potential adversaries that was seriously undermined by the Hamas attack on October the 7th. And secondly, I think there's also an element of embarrassment in Israel about the colossal failure of intelligence and military planning that allowed Hamas to strike such a deadly blow on October the 7th. So based upon these two impulses, I think Israel's desire to respond is certainly very understandable. Unfortunately, however, my sense is that the Israeli leadership acted after October 7th without thinking through the consequences of its invasion of Gaza or what happens when this war is eventually over. Israel also responded without seriously considering the humanitarian implications of conducting a war in such a densely populated urban area. As a result, Israel's onslaught against Hamas has resulted in staggering levels of human suffering and raised legitimate questions about the consistency of Israel's conduct with the principles of international law. In terms of Israel's war objectives, Prime Minister Netanyahu talks of what he refers to as total victory, but he hasn't clearly said what he means by total victory. The more precisely stated official goals of the Israeli military operation are twofold. Number one, to destroy Hamas's military and governmental capabilities, and number two, to free the Israeli hostages. However, accomplishing the first goal is not fully possible, and achieving the second goal is at odds, at least to some extent, with the first. In short, Israel has entered into a war it can't fully win, but cannot afford to lose. Israel is at risk, I fear, of falling into a quagmire, akin in some ways to the American experience in Vietnam or Afghanistan. Now, let me unpack a little bit why I believe Israel can't fully accomplish its goals in Gaza. Hamas is simultaneously a terrorist organization, a political party, a social movement, and at least up to the beginning of the war, the governing structure in Gaza. Hamas has strong support among some segments of the Palestinian population. Now, while the Israeli military operation has significantly degraded Hamas's military capabilities in Gaza, the military cannot completely eliminate an organization that operates literally underground and enjoys some level of popular support. Military means can degrade an opponent's military capabilities, and the Israeli military is certainly doing this to Hamas in Gaza right now. But military means are not effective at eliminating a political movement. As a result of the IDF, the Israeli Defense Forces offensive, Hamas is no longer able to operate as a conventional military force in Gaza. However, it continues as an irregular force and continues to inflict losses against Israeli troops. Israel has made it so Hamas cannot govern Gaza, but it has done this by creating conditions that make it impossible for anyone to govern in Gaza under the current circumstances. This situation leaves the Israeli army stuck in an ungoverned space in Gaza, battling a determined insurgency it cannot defeat, yet unwilling to pull out and thereby allow the insurgents to regain control of the area. This lack of realistic objectives for the war is compounded by Israel's lack of a credible plan for the day after. Israel understandably does not want Hamas to rule Gaza after the fighting comes to an end. It also doesn't want to rule Gaza itself and be responsible for the welfare of 2.2 million Palestinians there. That too is understandable. But Israel has also objected to the Palestinian Authority, which is based in Ramallah in the West Bank, from returning to Gaza after the war. The PA, as it is called, ruled Gaza until 2007, when Hamas forcibly took control there. Recently, the Israeli government floated a vague plan for what it called local stakeholders with managerial experience to run civil affairs in Gaza after the war under Israeli security control. This approach simply won't work. There are no local notables who exist that would take on this responsibility, and anybody who tried would quickly be labeled by most Palestinians as an Israeli collaborator. The only option that I see for post-war governance that has any hope of working involves the Palestinian Authority, yet the current Israeli government remains opposed to that option. That position, I think, is untenable in the long term. For the first 4 months of the war, Prime Minister Netanyahu actively prevented any serious discussion in Israel of the day after. This lack of planning is, in fact, his preferred approach. His popularity has plummeted since October 7th, and he knows that he will face a political reckoning after this war eventually ends. So it seems to me his political interest is to prolong the war and to delay this reckoning. That is a major factor in Israel's reluctance to accept a long-term ceasefire or even to begin a serious discussion of the arrangements for the day after. Let me now turn to the implications for U.S. interests across the wider region. Beyond the fighting in Gaza, the war has triggered clashes across the region, from the border between Israel and Lebanon to the Red Sea and inside Iraq and in Syria. The West Bank and East Jerusalem also remain tense, particularly in this period leading up to the Islamic holy month of Ramadan. There are a range of Iranian-backed militant groups, including Hezbollah in Lebanon, the Houthis in Yemen, and an assortment of popular resistance movements in Syria and Iraq that have attacked Israeli or American targets or interests in recent months. Looming behind all of these groups is Iran. While I doubt that Iran is orchestrating these attacks on a day-to-day level, it seems to me that Iran has given these groups a green light to harass the U.S. and Israel up to a point. What Iran does not want is a full-on war with the United States or with Israel, which it cannot win, but it is happy to operate in this gray zone, short of war, in order to inflict pain on its enemies, Israel and the United States. Now, the Biden administration, in my view, also does not want a wider conflict, especially in an election year. So if neither the U.S. nor Israel wants a wider war, we should be okay, right? Well, maybe yes, but also maybe no. The real danger that I see is not that either side wants a war, but it's that one side or the other may miscalculate and trigger a wider conflict that nobody wants. The United States and the Biden administration have been carefully trying to thread this needle, responding strongly when attacked, but limiting its operations in a way that won't provoke the Iranians to escalate further. So far, the administration has been successful, but dangers abound. Perhaps the most serious potential flashpoint is the Lebanon-Israel border. Since October 7th, Hezbollah has been launching cross-border attacks against Israeli targets in solidarity with Hamas, and the Israeli Defense Forces have been responding in kind. Up to this point, both sides have mostly limited these military operations to a narrow strip of land on both sides of the border. Like Iran, Hezbollah does not seem to want a wider war. But in Israel, there are mixed views. Shortly after October the 7th, the IDF and the defense minister, Yoav Gallant, pushed for a preemptive Israeli attack on Hezbollah. Others in the Israeli war cabinet opposed this, and President Biden made it clear that the United States did not want Israel to initiate hostilities in the north. And PM and Prime Minister Netanyahu ultimately decided against it. A full-scale war between Israel and Hezbollah would be devastating for both sides, resulting in widespread casualties and major damage to major population centers in both countries. And it is unlikely that Iran would stay on the sidelines if its ally Hezbollah came under a heavy attack by Israel. So the implications for U.S. interests here are considerable. Within the region, the U.S. has numerous allies and a network of military bases. We want to protect our allies, our interests, and our deployed forces. We seek stability in the region and place a high priority on protecting freedom of navigation, particularly where it is threatened, as in the Red Sea right now. International trade is the foundation of the global economy, and U.S. prosperity depends on it. Beyond the region, the U.S. also has significant global strategic interests, including supporting Ukraine against Russian aggression and countering China's competitive aspirations for global leadership. This leads the United States to generally prefer stability in the Middle East in order to avoid getting enmeshed in a regional conflict there that would constrain our ability to deal with these other global challenges. So let me look ahead a little bit and see where I think we may be headed. In this complicated environment, the Biden administration has been proactive in trying to diminish tensions and bring the Gaza conflict to some resolution. This is a notable change from the period before October 7th, when the administration did not consider the Middle East, and especially the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, to be a top priority. The administration has realized the hard way that when you ignore the Middle East, it usually comes back to bite you. After the October 7th attacks, President Biden offered strong support to Israel, and there was widespread sympathy for Israel, not only in the United States, but around the world. But since then, U.S. and Israeli interests have begun to diverge. The administration has repeatedly urged Israel to take more care to avoid civilian casualties in Gaza, to allow in greater levels of humanitarian assistance, and to engage in a serious dialogue about the day after. U.S. opposition to continued Israeli settlement activity in the West Bank has also become more vocal. Prime Minister Netanyahu has up until now avoided an open confrontation with Washington, but he has done little or nothing to accommodate these American concerns, setting the stage for more disagreement down the line. And in the past few days, the exchange of commentary between President Biden and Prime Minister Netanyahu has escalated. And I think it reflecting the growing frustration in Washington about the direction that Prime Minister Netanyahu is leading the country. In this complex environment, U.S. diplomacy has been active. Secretary of State Blinken has traveled to the region numerous times to deal with the array of issues facing the United States. He has been supported by CIA Director Bill Burns, who is focused on the release of Israeli hostages held by Hamas. Special Envoy Amos Hochstein has led efforts to defuse tensions on the Israel-Lebanon border, and National Security Council Coordinator Brett McGurk has concentrated on the role Saudi Arabia and other regional allies could play in a post-war transformation of the region. All of these efforts are part of a broad regional approach that New York Times columnist Tom Friedman has referred to as the Biden Doctrine. In brief, this approach, as described by Friedman, has three elements: a stronger pushback against malign Iranian influence across the region, a renewed push for a two-state solution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, and normalization between Israel and Saudi Arabia as part of a stronger U.S.-Saudi relationship. This grand strategy has a certain logic to it, as it attempts to deal with all of the main issues in the region in a coordinated and self-reinforcing way. But one thing we can be certain of is that accomplishing these strategic objectives will not be easy, and they will not be quick. The essential first step to unlock the path toward a more stable region is a sustainable end to the fighting in Gaza. Reaching this goal has been difficult for many reasons, but I think primarily because important parts of the Israeli government don't want a ceasefire. As I noted earlier, Prime Minister Netanyahu's political interest is to prolong the fighting and to postpone the political reckoning that awaits him when the war ends. There's been an interesting evolution of the commentary by the Biden administration about this. If you recall, in the beginning of the war, the administration would only talk about a humanitarian pause, and they resisted any use of the word ceasefire. Now the president is openly calling for a ceasefire, and he and the vice president have even spoken about the need for an immediate ceasefire. In terms of what the Israeli government is looking for as an end state in Gaza, I think it's something that looks like a reinforced version of what currently exists in the northern West Bank. There, the Palestinian Authority is nominally in charge, but Israeli security forces operate freely as they want to on a daily basis. I think this is what Israel wants in Gaza in the long term. Now, whether Israel can accomplish this end state in Gaza is uncertain. Hamas remains strong in Gaza and is not going to be as accommodating to Israel as the Palestinian Authority has been in the West Bank. And even if Israel can implement this model in Gaza, it is not a remedy for conflict. In fact, it is a prescription for continued violence that takes the two sides even farther from any resolution of the underlying conflict. However the Gaza war ends, a key action item for the United States going forward should be a renewed effort to address the underlying Israeli-Palestinian conflict through a negotiating process that leads to a two-state solution. While this goal seems far-fetched now and is only achievable in the longer term, starting a credible pathway towards this outcome is essential to unlocking the support of Saudi Arabia and other Arab partners to a broader transformation of the region. I think we should not lose sight of some fundamental facts about this conflict. Between the Jordan River and the Mediterranean Sea, there are roughly 15 million people. About half of them, 7.5 million, are Arabs, and half of them are Jews. Neither the Arabs or the Jews are going anywhere, and they're going to have to find a way to live with each other. And in the long term, I think only a two-state solution provides the only plausible opportunity for the national aspirations of both sides to be met and for the two people to live in peace. The obstacles to this are certainly considerable, and a key impediment is the diminishing support within Israel for a two-state solution. So I think the government in Israel, together with public opinion, will have to change in order for progress to be achieved. Now, I don't want to suggest that all of the impediments lie on the Israeli side. To be sure, Hamas is a very large obstacle to peace. It is, after all, a terrorist organization. The Palestinian Authority itself needs serious reform and new leadership as well. And the Arab states will certainly have to step up in ways that they haven't done so before. None of this will be easy or quick either. But the necessary changes on the Arab side will have to be accompanied by a different approach going forward from Israel as well. Addressing these challenges will be a tall order for the Biden administration, especially with an election going on. but to promote and protect U.S. interests in the region, the administration will have to remain much more active than it was in the period before October 7th. As I said, the Middle East has a way of coming back to bite you when it is ignored. And President Biden and his team would be well advised not to ignore the Middle East again. So that concludes my prepared remarks. It was a pleasure to speak to you today, and I do look forward to taking your questions, which I'm sure will be quite interesting. So thank you.
Thank you very much, Jake. Given us an awful lot to think about here. I think we've all been thinking about these issues for a while, and this is adds to the complexity, I think, of our thinking. What I always do while they're collecting questions from our members and their guests is to take the opportunity to ask a question of my own. And I had a whole bunch of questions here, but I wondered if you could address, you talked a little bit about the discussions between Israel and Saudi Arabia to try to normalize, do greater normalization of that. Could you talk about the broader impact on U.S.-Arab relations and Israeli-Arab relations that this conflict is going to have?
That's a great question. I mean, one of the challenges U.S. diplomacy has faced in this region for decades is how to balance our support for Israel, which is quite strong, with our close relationships with many Arab countries. And that's always been a challenge, and I think it's a challenge this time as well. One of the efforts that the Biden administration has done, which actually follows on work that was done in the Trump administration and before, is to promote normalization between Israel and the Arab states that did not have relations with Israel. Under President Trump, Israel established relationships with the United Arab Emirates and Bahrain and Morocco. That's on top of the relations with Egypt and Jordan that go back many decades. But the key piece of that that's missing is Saudi Arabia. So there's been an effort under the Biden administration before the war began to promote that normalization. I think that's stalled at the moment given the situation with the war going on. But both the Saudis and the Israelis and the Americans have made it clear that as part of a resolution of this conflict in Gaza, they want to see that normalization continue, and specifically normalization between Israel and Saudi Arabia. But as I said in my remarks, that's not going to happen without a resolution to the conflict in Gaza that promotes a two-state solution. I think that there's no way that the Saudis or the other Arabs are going to be part of this, part of the process that does not include some movement towards a two-state solution. So I think that's the key.
Thank you very much.
Looks like you got a lot of questions.
Well, there. We've got a lot of questions, and I'm trying to get some sorted here.
Maybe I should extend my flight back.
Well, we'll do the best we can here. This is one of the first that came in, so let me ask it. Can a two-state solution happen if the Arabs continue to insist on the right of return? That seems to be a big issue that's been around for a long, long time.
Yeah, that's been an obstacle in the negotiations from the beginning. I think the Arab states will support whatever the Palestinians support. And as part of the negotiations in the past that I was involved in, there was some discussion about how to address the refugee question, which is one of the final status issues in the negotiation. And while they never reached an agreement on it, I do believe that they made some progress. And the idea that it was bandied about in those days that there would be some return, that most of the return of the refugees would be to the Palestinian state, not to Israel, but there would be at least some token number of Palestinians who would be able to return to what is now Israel. But those are the issues that have to be negotiated between the Israelis and the Palestinians. That's why we need to get a negotiating process going again. And once that process begins, once there's an agreement between Israel and the Palestinians, I'm confident that the Arab states would come on board as well.
Why not a one-state solution?
As I said, there are 15 million people there. Half of them are Arabs and half of them are Jews. And none of them want to live in a state that's dominated by the other group. So the only plausible way both groups get their national aspirations met is in a state of their own. I don't think Israelis want a one-state solution because that means it's not the one state would not be a Jewish state. And Palestinians, I do not think want a state in which half of the population is Jewish. So I don't think a one-state solution is feasible.
Then there's several questions here, and I haven't gathered them all together then, but related to, can you discuss the extent to which the U.S. could engage other countries, i.e. the U.K., the EU, or others, to help diffuse the risk? Why is the U.S. being singled out as the key to making this happen?
Well, the short answer is the U.S. is the only country that has any influence with Israel. Although, given the current situation, it's not clear how much influence we actually have. But so I think for that reason, the United States is going to be a critical player in this as well. But I don't think we're doing it alone. And I don't think we want to exclude either the Europeans or the Arab states from having a role in this process. If you look at, just to take the humanitarian response to what the situation in Gaza, it's definitely not the U.S. acting alone. The Europeans are providing assistance, and they're funding much of the assistance that's going into Gaza. The Europeans are also part of this effort to establish a maritime corridor from Cyprus to Gaza to provide a better flow of humanitarian assistance. And the Gulf states, the Saudis, the Emiratis, and the Jordanians as well, are providing some of this assistance. The Jordanians are very active in the airdrops of assistance. So I would say that the others are involved and the United States wants to bring them in, but I think the United States has to play a role as well.
Seems to be the case throughout the world. A couple here related...
That's one result of being the only superpower left at the moment.
I agree. There's several here related to a similar question. You said that the only hope for establishing a Palestinian leadership in Gaza is the Palestinian Authority. Mm-hmm. And you said that would be difficult. How difficult would it be for the Palestinian Authority to get to the point where they could take over and be the principal ruling party?
Yeah, that's a good authority. Question. I didn't go into a lot of detail on that, but I'll try to answer the question now. The obstacles are many. I mean, part of it is that Hamas still wants to maintain its influence in Gaza, and Hamas is not making it easy for the Palestinian Authority to operate there. After all, you go back to 2007, Hamas forcibly took over Gaza and expelled the Palestinian Authority from Gaza. So they're not, Hamas is not part of the solution here as well. As far as the Palestinian Authority itself is concerned, it has very low popular support in the West Bank where it governs. It's considered corrupt. Its president is considered to be old and out of touch with Palestinian needs. He was old when we were working there, Mika, if you recall, and he's a lot older now than he was then. So the Palestinian Authority itself is going to have to reform. It needs new leadership. It needs to end the corruption. It needs to become more effective as a governmental structure than it's been over the last decade or more. So those are some of the obstacles to the PA coming back into Gaza. And I didn't mention the Israelis. I talked a lot about the Israelis in my remarks. But the current Israeli government is opposed to the Palestinian Authority coming back. They're not doing anything now to help the Palestinian Authority govern in the West Bank, where they are in charge, let alone facilitating them to come into some governmental role in Gaza. So I think all of those things are going to have to change for this to work. But I don't see any other way.
I don't see a logical way to ask these questions, so I'm going to jump around a bit here. But you commented that part of the extension of the war is that Netanyahu knows what will happen when it ends, that he's his political future. The question is, do the Israelis realize that Bibi is not eager for an end to the war?
I think Israel, first of all, Israel is very polarized the way many countries are. So there are a lot of people who support Netanyahu, and there are a lot of people that are very much opposed to Netanyahu. And that existed before the war, and it continues to this day. What I think is influenced the situation is that Netanyahu has been held responsible by a lot of the Israeli people for what happened on October 7th, that Israel wasn't prepared, that Israel, under Netanyahu's leadership, had allowed Hamas to gain strength in Gaza, that Israel allowed Qatar to fund Hamas in Gaza with the hope that that would keep Hamas quiet. Those policies did not succeed, and they, I think, contributed to what happened on October the 7th. And a lot of Israelis know that, and they want this reckoning when the war ends. Netanyahu is trying to hold on to power because he's still under indictment for several criminal offenses that go back many years. His trial has been going on for now a couple of years. The legal system in Israel is very different to ours. Ours operates much more quickly than the way things do in Israel. So Netanyahu, his way of dealing with his legal problems is to hold on to power, which has certain echoes in this country as well, that I don't think I want to get into right now. But Netanyahu's interest is to hold on to power and to delay this reckoning as long as possible. I think many Israelis see that. Many Israelis are opposed to that. But as I said at the beginning, Israel is a very polarized country.
So this is, maybe you've answered this, but I had it ready to ask anyway. Why do the Israeli people have to wait for the war to be over to replace their leadership? Isn't he getting weaker? Isn't Netanyahu getting weaker, even in Israel, as this goes on?
Yes, he's getting, well, he's certainly much weaker than he was before October 7th. And I think as time goes by, and particularly as the relationship with the United States deteriorates, his support goes down. The difficulty is the way the political system works in Israel. It's a parliamentary system. There was an election about 15 months ago where Netanyahu and his coalition partners won a majority of the seats in the Knesset, the parliament. I think if the election were held today, and certainly the polling bears this out, that those parties would not get a majority if there were an election today, but they hold a majority right now. And until either one of the parties in the coalition pulls out or Netanyahu's own party replaces him with somebody else, that government continues in power. Now, politics in Israel is very fluid, so depending on how the results of this war come about, it could bring down the government. But it's not an automatic thing, and there's a big discrepancy now between the results of the election that was held before October 7th and popular opinion in Israel right now.
And a couple related to a little near-term history here. What was Israel's long-term plan for Gaza prior to October?
Well, I think the plan was to try to deter Hamas. And the way they wanted to deter Hamas was to enmesh them in the responsibility for government in Gaza and provide economic incentives to them through the money that the Qataris were providing and employment for Palestinians from Gaza inside Israel, with the hope that those things would provide incentives for Hamas not to engage in this kind of attack against Israel, knowing that the consequences would be quite severe for Hamas, that they would lose the economic benefits, they would lose the governmental role that they have in Gaza before the war. Hamas was not deterred. Hamas's calculations were different. It's hard to understand exactly what Hamas had in mind. Hamas is quite opaque in their planning. They don't give press conferences the way most governments do. So I think that was the Israeli approach, was to try to deter Hamas. It failed miserably, and we saw the results on October the 7th. And that's part of why there's going to be this reckoning in Israel after the war.
Part of that reckoning, I think, is related to this question, and that is, was the October 7th attack on Israel an Israel intelligence failure, as it has been characterized by the press? And were the Israelis preoccupied with other things so that they missed this?
It was a perfect storm in a lot of ways. There were many different factors. Part of it was an intelligence failure, although frankly it was not an issue of not having the intelligence. It was a question of not analyzing the intelligence that they had properly. There were warning signs that the Israeli intelligence agencies picked up before October 7th, including immediately before October 7th, that were not evaluated properly. Part of the reason for that is that there was this, what they call in Israel, a conception, and that was that Hamas had been deterred, as I was talking about earlier. So even when they saw intelligence pointing otherwise, they were convinced that Hamas was deterred and would not mount this kind of attack. So that was part of it. There was an aspect of it that was an intelligence failure. There was also a huge failure in planning by the Israeli military, that whether or not they expected Hamas to attack on that given day, they did not have the troops positioned properly to respond to any potential attack from Hamas. It happened to be a Jewish holiday the day that Hamas attacked. Many of the soldiers were on leave. Israel had also increasingly been relying on electronics to gather intelligence, cameras, listening devices, rather than having troops positioned near the border. So when they saw Hamas crossing through the camp with the cameras, they didn't have troops positioned in order to respond on a timely basis. So that's the other aspect of it. There was intelligence failure, there was a planning failure, and there was also a political failure at the top, focusing on other issues. As you recall, and you alluded to this in your question, before this war in Gaza, Israel was totally preoccupied with this conflict over judicial reform. What is the role of the High Court in Israel? Does the legislature have the power to overturn the High Court? There were protests in the streets almost every week on this issue. So the country itself was distracted and not really thinking about the dangers that it faced. So basically across the board, whether it's the military, the intelligence agencies, the political leadership, there was a failure to prepare properly for what, and we saw the result on October the 7th.
I think you've kind of addressed this somewhat in the past, but I want to ask it straight on. How does Israel think this war will make it safer when the treatment of the Palestinians seems to bound to make more enemies for within that community?
Well, I'm sympathetic to the spirit behind that question. I don't think it makes Israel stronger in the long term. But the Israelis view things differently. The Israelis view this as an existential threat to Israel. That if Hamas can do what they did on October the 7th, and they're not prevented from doing it again, they will continue to do it again. Hezbollah could do the same thing in northern Israel. At the moment, Israeli civilians in the northern part of Israel, within 10 miles of the border with Lebanon, have all been evacuated since October, and they're living in hotels in other parts of Israel. That's also an untenable situation for Israel over the long term. So there is fear in Israel about what would happen, not just with Hamas in the future, but with Hezbollah down the road, and even beyond that with Iran. So I think Israel feels the need to respond strongly to what Hamas did. But as I said, I think it has consequences in the long term as well.
And a couple now on recently announced U.S. effort to establish a temporary port. How do you think Israel will react to a temporary port being established in North Gaza?
Well, the Israeli government officially says that they're working with the United States on this. And in fact, I even saw a press report this morning from an Israeli source that said that the idea originally was Netanyahu's idea, that he's claiming credit for this. Now, I don't actually believe that. I think the Israelis are probably troubled by this port, but they don't want to heighten the differences with the United States at the moment. It's very hard for Israel to object to what the United States is doing. My own view about this port is that in the short run, it's not going to make much difference. The only way that people are starving right now in Gaza, and the only way to get large amounts of humanitarian assistance and food into Gaza is by land, by trucks, through the existing crossing points. But in the longer term, this port could transform things. One of the reasons that's holding up humanitarian assistance from going in over land right now is the Israelis are insisting on inspecting everything that goes into Gaza. And we have experience of that from the past. The way the United States is setting this up, the maritime corridor, is that the Israelis will be allowed to inspect the goods in Cyprus. The difference is that the Israelis won't be able to control events in Cyprus the way they do on their own borders. So the Israelis may get to inspect things in Cyprus, but they won't get to block things in Cyprus in the same way. So in the long term, having a maritime corridor allows the ability for Gaza to trade with the outside world and to receive assistance from the outside world without the Israelis having as much control over that. So I think that could be transformational over the long term. But in the short run, I think Gazans are still going to have to rely on food and other essentials coming in overland.
And doesn't the fact that it's going to take, we've heard, up to two months to establish support, mean the U.S. expects this to be a very extensive and long war?
I think so. I think the United States is looking to the long term as well. They've said it's going to take several months to get this set up. It's not clear exactly how this is going to work, because the Pentagon has said we're not going to put forces of our own into Gaza. So we're going to assemble a pier off the coast in some way, which sounds pretty daunting to me, but I don't know a lot about naval engineering. But then they're going to have to connect this to the land in some way, and you're going to have people on the ground to at least do that part of it. And those are not going to be Americans. It's not clear who is going to do that. I don't think the Israelis are going to do that. I don't think we want the Israelis to do that. So some third party is going to have to do that, whether it's the Egyptians or I'm not sure who else. So there are a lot of unanswered questions about how this is going to work.
So sticking with the U.S. role in this, how much credibility has the U.S. sacrificed by refusing to support multiple U.N. ceasefire resolutions?
I think there's a downside to doing this. We've been very clear that about what we're prepared to accept and what we're not prepared to accept, and to use the veto as necessary to hold that line. I think the administration has lost some credibility as a result of that. I think that's true. I think the administration is reluctant to use the veto any further. And in fact, the U.S. has now drafted a resolution for a ceasefire, which reflects this evolution of our policy that I was talking about. Whereas in the beginning, we wouldn't even use the word ceasefire. Now we're actually drafting a resolution in the Security Council talking about at least a temporary ceasefire of at least 6 weeks. So there's been some evolution. I think that reflects the administration's concern about the impact that this is having, not just in the Arab world, but even more broadly than that.
And sticking still again with U.S. actions related to this, what effect would the withdrawal of U.S. military support for Israel have on the political resolution of the conflict?
Well, the administration has been reluctant to use that tool. We provide a lot of military assistance to Israel. I think they're the largest recipient historically of U.S. military assistance of any place, of any country in the world. The president talked about this a little bit in this interview I referred to that he gave last night, where he was pointing out that the assistance we provide Israel has in many cases defensive uses, such as the Iron Dome, anti-aircraft shield, anti-missile shield, and we don't want to make Israel any less able to defend itself. He left open the question of what we might do about more offensive weapons and the air-to-ground bombs that we provide to Israel. So he didn't come out and say, but there was a hint that he might put this on the table in the future. But it's clear that he does not want to do that, but if Netanyahu continues to resist his entreaties for a ceasefire and to reduce civilian casualties, the administration may actually be prepared to go that far, which would be, I wouldn't say unprecedented, but very rare in the history of U.S.-Israeli relations.
Let's hear someone wants to know about Tony Blinken himself. Does Blinken seem weak to you? He has certainly not been a Kissinger-like figure in the Middle East.
Well, nobody is a Kissinger-like figure. I think Secretary Biden reflects the positions that the president takes. The president, I think, is very engaged in this issue. He's been involved in the Middle East issues for a very, very long time. I remember when I was in Jerusalem, Senator Biden at the time came out during one of the Palestinian elections to see what was going on. He likes to speak about how he's met every Israeli prime minister since Golda Meir. Most Israelis don't even remember Golda Meir. I think President Biden is directing the policy, and I think Secretary Blinken is implementing it quite effectively, or as effectively as he can, given the constraints of all the many conflicting pressures on this policy at the moment.
Someone was interested in knowing, since the press has reported that part of October 7th was catalyzed by the pending Israeli-Saudi rapprochement, Couldn't Saudi Arabia play, or shouldn't Saudi Arabia play a bigger role in trying to end this conflict?
That's an interesting question. I don't think Hamas was motivated primarily about the potential rapprochement. I think they have other interests. And they were responding to their own agenda, not so much the Saudis. But in terms of whether Saudi Arabia has a role to play in resolving this conflict, I think they do. I think the Saudis hold one large card, which is normalization with Israel, which Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman has indicated they're prepared to play that card, but only in return for some progress towards a two-state solution, and some clear and convincing progress towards a two-state solution, not just mere words, but something more credible. So I think that card will allow the Saudis to play an important role in bringing this conflict to an end. But there are so many moving pieces that it's not up to the Saudis alone. It depends as well on Hamas. Iran has a role in this, not a positive role, but a spoiler role. So there are many pieces to this puzzle that have to be put together.
We can't, of course, have any meeting without introducing climate change into the meeting. So someone wanted to know, is there a link? Can you link this war to the convergence of population pressure and climate change, i.e. no place for population to go, and inflation and shortages due to climate change? Are there other factors involved in
this? I think that's a factor globally in terms of the migration crisis that the world is facing right now, both at our southern border, but you see similar things happening on European borders and on the Mediterranean. I don't know that this is the primary factor that's driving things between Israel and the Palestinians, but it could be contributing as well.
And then right back to the U.S., and what sense should we make of the pivot to away from the Middle East? Was it a mistake to turn our attention away, and what has turned out to be a real problem area, continue to be a real problem area?
I think so, and I said that in my remarks, that I think it's a mistake to ignore the Middle East. You do so at your own peril. You know, the administration had been clear about focus on China and the competition there, and more recently the focus on Ukraine and responding to the Russian aggression there. Those were the top priorities for the administration. They remain important priorities, but I think the mistake that was made before October 7th was thinking that we could ignore the Middle East and it would just kind of go away. And that turned out to be a big mistake. I think the administration understands that now.
A little late. Then the one, I think I'll end on this one. The one question that got that was asked in various forms by the most people was, how will the situation change if Trump is elected president?
Well, it's hard to say, because a lot is going to happen between now and November, or between now and January, independent of who wins our election. There are going to be events between, you know, will Israel invade Rafah or not, the southern part of Gaza? Will Iran get involved? Will this be a wider war? So all of those factors will influence whatever the next administration will be facing, whether that's a Biden administration in a second term or a Trump administration in a second term. So there's so many factors that would go into things before then. It's hard to really make a prediction. I will say that Trump had a complicated relationship with Netanyahu. In a lot of ways, they're similar kinds of politicians, and they think and operate the same way. For the most part, they had a really good relationship when Trump was president. But since then, Trump has been very critical of Netanyahu. So I'm not sure what the personal relationship is between the two of them. I think Netanyahu is looking forward to a second Trump term. I think in some ways, you think that may be his get-out-of-jail-free card in a way. So with that said, I'm not sure I have a clear answer to that one, but...
Well, answered like a diplomat.
Well, that's what I did for most of my life, so... but I think there are many differences between Trump and Biden that go beyond the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, so it'll be an interesting year. Politically, for sure.
I think we could all agree with that.
We don't count on that.
I wanted to thank you very much. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. Today's program featured a discussion hosted by the Midcoast Forum on Foreign Relations with diplomat Jake Wallace. If you missed part of the program or want to listen again, you can also find it on our website, mainepublic.org. Click on radio to access this program and many other archived Speaking in Maine programs. Music in this hour comes from Our Alarm Clock. Susan Tran is the executive producer of Speaking in Maine, and Speaking in Maine is produced by me, Jane Donahue. Thanks for joining us. This is Maine Public Radio.